Hello, and welcome to another episode of What Makes You Click. I'm your host, Kelvin Bullock. And on today's episode, I've got a guest who is not only an amazing photographer, but is also a good friend of mine. And I really got a chance to get to know him a little bit better through the course of this conversation. And I learned about what he would call the back door into this industry. And I think it's a very good episode for anyone who's looking to break into the industry to hear, because as we all know, there's definitely more than one way to do anything. And that's certainly no different when it comes to working in this industry, whether it be for commercial, fashion, celebrity, whatever it is that you're looking to do. So it's definitely a great episode. So without further ado, let's take a listen to hear what makes Mr. Derek Reed click. Hey, man, I appreciate you for jumping on this call with me and agreeing to have this conversation. I know that I've known you for a little while now, so it's going to be interesting to have this type of conversation with you and dig a little bit deeper into who you are as a creative and as just a human being in general.
Well, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And, you know, anytime I'm having a conversation with someone, I think back to how I first became aware of them or was introduced to them. And for you, it's a bit of a special story, because the first time I became aware of you as an artist was through a mutual friend and fellow photographer of ours by the name of John Ellis. And he had posted, I believe you guys had had some type of holiday party or New Year's party. I don't know what it was, but it ended up being some type of party with a whole bunch of black photographers. And he had posted some images from it. And I'm like, who are all of these black photographers out here doing their thing? Like, this is amazing. I didn't know there was communities like this. You know what I'm saying? And so I started clicking
We also had a couple of Latin photographers there.
Okay, yeah.
And I brought a couple of women photographers also. And I just kind of saw it as, oh yeah, we're the folks who are normally fighting for inclusion. And because at first it was kind of a boys network, and I kind of came in and was just like, oh, you know something, guys, this isn't going to work, because most of the times on my cruise or so, it's normally girls that I'm bringing on as assistants. So, or Digitex. So yeah, let's get the ladies on in here also. But yeah, that was definitely one of those things where I kind of came in and was a little disruptive to their little boys club and got them to bring in some girls also.
Yeah. And so he posted those photos, and I'm like, yeah, like who are all, and like you said, there was definitely a wide range of people of color there. So, and that was the other thing that really kind of excited me, because like I said, this was a couple of years ago, and I'm seeing, you know, and I'm here in the DC area. So seeing you guys up in New York, just doing your thing and having those type of functions, it really just drew my attention. So when I started just clicking on all of the different photographers, I came across your work, and, you know, of course I started following you immediately because your work is amazing. And, you know, I'm scrolling up and down your feed, and I'm looking at your website, and I'm like, yo, like, Derek is out here doing his thing. And I love his just clean, you know, editorial style. So yeah, I've been a fan ever since then. And then had to have been a couple of years ago, I had a chance to meet you in person during an event that SVA was having, where they were highlighting some different, you know, photographers and editors, and they were telling their story. So I got a chance to meet you and a couple of your other photographer friends, as I call them. And yeah, we ended up having a good time, had drinks afterwards. And yeah, I loved your energy. So I'm glad to finally be able to talk to you in this capacity.
All right. Yeah, that was a fun night. If I recall right, Tom Payne was one of the speakers, and I want to say he's like at a car magazine now. And Tracy Woods, who was one of the speakers also, who has been a dear friend and has hired me on more than a few occasions or so, and she is now heading up, I believe, The Loop. Once again, I feel like I'm plugging the fairer sex again, but The Loop is a great organization out there that's trying to fight for gender equality within the photo world. And if there's any female photographers out there listening right now, please look up The Loop and consider joining.
Oh, thank you for plugging that. And as a matter of fact, I will throw a link up in the show notes because we are all about equality here. And yeah, man, like you said, that was a great event. We had a good time. And I feel like even before the event started, we had a little bit of time to kind of sit back and chat a little bit. And we talked about our views on photography, and you talked about what makes an iconic image. And, you know, just those type of conversations are actually what inspired me to even start this podcast. And so now what I'd like to do is take it all the way back. And I want to learn a little bit more about your origin stories. So where originally are you and your family from? Like, where did you grow up?
Okay, let's see here. I'm more or less born in Mississippi, a little small town called Greenville. The most famous person from Greenville is probably Jim Henson. Yeah. But he's like, after Jim Henson, nobody else. Yeah. But my dad was in the Marines and we moved around quite a bit. So more or less, like, I think I left Greenville by the time I was 8 years old or so. Wound up in the Midwest, first St. Louis, then suburbs of Chicago, and then Orlando Naval Air Station down there, where I graduated from high school at in Orlando, Florida.
Oh, wow. And so I can definitely relate to you with being a quote unquote military brat. My mom was in the Army, so we moved around quite a bit as well. Sounds like you got to move to some more interesting places than what our family did. But how was that experience for you growing up and having to, you know, continually uproot yourself and almost in a sense reinvent yourself every time you found yourself in a new place? Like, what was that like growing up? And during that time, was there any particular creative interest that you had or were drawn to?
I would say that it really didn't affect me, I don't think, until you get to high school. And then all of a sudden, you know, because at that point you kind of feel like, oh, I'm an adult, my friends mean anything, it mean everything. And what's really funny is if you're a military kid, all of a sudden you realize that half these people you can't even remember once you're an adult. But, you know, you're in high school, you put a lot of emphasis on that or so. And I have to honestly say that one of the good things about moving to Orlando was that there was a dark room on base, which was nice. I mean, like, I had taken photography in high school when I was in Darien, Illinois. The good thing was that, like, you know, even though it was public school, it was a fairly affluent neighborhood or well-to-do school system there in DuPage County, and they actually had photo program. You had to basically, you know, you had to be shooting with your own cameras and that sort of thing, but they had a dark room, which was pretty spectacular. But then when I got to Orlando or so, the base had a dark room, which was just great. And I think at the time, you basically had to pay like $5 or something, and it was just all you could print. And that was pretty amazing for, you know, a kid who just really kind of was fascinated with taking a lot of bad pictures of rusted out cars and dead trees. So,
yeah. Just to go back for a second, you had mentioned that there was that school and you were there and you saw that they had that program, but you also mentioned that you had to have a camera or be shooting with your own camera. So when did you first pick up a camera? Like, how did that even come about?
Well, I want to say the first time everybody's got like that great story about, like, you know, my father gave me my first camera at age 12. Yeah. I come from a black military family where it was like, I brought this camera back from Vietnam. Don't you dare put your little grubby hands on it for fear that you're going to break it like you break everything else. So instead, he gave me a Yashica 126 that he didn't care about. I think he got this one before he got his Canon. What was it? It was a Canon FTB at the time. So he gave me this Yashica mat that was a 126. And I just remember you could barely find film from it. And this is like even in the 80s. And so I bring it in. And of course, like everyone else there who's in high school, like, you know, it's well-to-do school, they're all got like Canon AE-1s or that sort of thing. And here I am shooting with like a 126 camera. But the beauty of the 126 camera was this was a Yashica with a actual real lens on it. And had a bigger negative.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like it actually held up pretty well if you had to print up, like, say, an 11 by 14 or so. So that's kind of what I started off on. And then by the time I got to high school or so, I think that he'd say, I should say, not by the time I got to high school, by the time we moved to Orlando, I think he had realized that, like, oh, he actually has some modicum of talent at it. So I finally got that AE-1 that I wanted. It came for Christmas my senior year. It was under the Christmas tree and it's pretty great.
That's what's up. And it also sounds like your father was really into photography as well. Did you find yourself looking to him at all for inspiration, or was there any chats that you guys would have about photography?
Not really. I mean, like my dad just wanted a good camera to shoot like, you know, his buddies with, or to shoot like family photos with. And I mean, like that was, you know, that was the thing back then. And we were never the family with a video recorder or that sort of thing. You know, it was just like the old man took pictures of the family, you know, and he's got boxes upon boxes of negatives that he's always like, you know, trying to get, basically dropping off with me still to this day to have scanned, because I don't trust those people down at Costco, that sort of thing. Meanwhile, I'm sitting here just going, yeah, let me try and fit that in, Dad, with the gazillion other things that I have going on. So, but yeah, that's kind of how it got started. And I want to say that probably even before my dad or so, maybe I'm guessing my grandmother was probably into it also, because there was I'm not going to say a ton, but there were at least six or seven, like more or less like Kodak Brownies, or there was also like a twin lens reflex or so that like you found out in her garage. Of course, the glass was all mildewed and she hadn't touched the thing since probably the 60s and had moved on to like, you know, a Polaroid or something by the time the 70s rolled around. But yeah, it was just more or less like, you know, a family full of documenting their experiences and putting it in a scrapbook. And it wasn't one of those things where, you know, anybody, I think I was probably the first person in the family to actually just go out and try and create something or try and capture the world as I saw it or as I encountered it.
I love hearing those stories of the families who were really like documentarians like that. Like, I don't think I really started to understand the importance of that until like a few years ago. And I've been shooting for some time, but the documenting of family cultures and history, like it's something that I find myself really interested in now. And when I hear stories like that, I can only imagine the scrapbooks and the photo albums that your family has. Like, they probably have some really solid imagery.
Yeah, I mean, like there's great photos even on my mom's side or so. My grandfather there was definitely into taking pictures, and he's probably the closest thing we'd have to, like, say, a documentarian or so, because, like, he's got photos from, like, pool halls in Mississippi from, like, you know, probably the 50s or so. And they're just amazing pictures. It's just him and, like, you know, his friends, or him and my grandmother, like, out on a date or that sort of thing. But it's like this world that you don't see anymore. And that in itself is rather special and rather lovely. And I think that there's a lot of people who dismiss that family photo or that sort of thing, but it kind of shows where you come from and where you're going. Like, who came before you? There's probably one of my favorite family photos we have is me. It's me. It's my father. It's my grandfather. And it's my great grandfather. Wow. And yeah, Whitelaw Reed. Whitelaw's father was Cherokee. His mom was a slave. And so it's just like, these generations there. And, you know, I look at that picture now as like a middle-aged man. And I'm just like, who is that child sitting there on, you know, what is my father's lap, or like my father's younger than I am at the time. Yeah. And you're just like looking at that and you're just like, wow, here I am. Here's this man, Whitelaw, who served in World War I and came back to face all sorts of discrimination. And even though he served his country honorably, his mother was born a slave. And then here I am here in New York City. And I'm not going to, you know, just kind of in this very privileged profession that I feel very lucky to be a part of. And when I think about the fact that I'm from this little small town in Mississippi where none of this, my life as it is, probably should have happened. Mm. Or it was not necessarily an option or something that, you know, my parents foresaw when I was probably coming into the world. I mean, like, there was one of us back then. There was Gordon Parks. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Okay. The rest were family photographers,
you know,
and a handful of journalists.
That again is powerful, that just from looking at that image and then having all of those realizations come to you, like, that is the power of photography. That is why I will forever love it. And it also makes me think about, there's this Instagram page. I don't know if maybe you've seen it. It's called Black Archives. I love going onto that feed and just looking at those images from, you know, spanning from the 90s all the way back to like the 40s and 50s. And, hearing what you're talking about makes me think you probably have some images that you could share with the Black Archives that they, you know, could put into their database. Like, that sounds amazing. But anyway, yeah, that.
Oh, I'm going to plug one other person. Yeah, also. Please. There's a guy, if your listeners are into that sort of imagery, there's a guy named Henry Clay Anderson. He published a book called his descendants published a book in probably, I want to say, like the late 90s or so. And it's called Separate But Equal. He was this photographer who documented the Mississippi Delta, and his work is just brilliant. He was a wedding photographer for the Black community in that little small town that I'm from, Greenville, Mississippi. You know, at the time, because he's in Mississippi and the newspaper there is not necessarily going to hire him to take photos, he did find a way to make a living doing, you know, the community there. But if you also look at what he documented, his work is amazing. Mm. And it's just one of those things that, like, you know, had he been born maybe in a different time, who knows where this man might have been.
You said the name of that book was called Separate But Equal.
Separate But Equal. And it is the photographic works of Henry Clay Anderson.
All right. I'm going to find a link to that and throw that in the show notes as well. I'm going to have to check it out for myself because, like I said, I definitely love checking out that type of imagery. And you said something a bit earlier when you were talking about how you would go out and you'd be taking photos of dead trees and rusted out vehicles.
Well, there's a ton of those in the suburbs of Orlando, especially in the late 80s or so. You just normally had to go into the neighborhoods where, how should I put this? There was normally an abundance of rebel flags. And yes, you could normally find like pretty much, you know, guys who would just basically like, I'm going to get that Camaro off these blocks one of these days. And yeah. So, but I mean, like at the same time, it was just because you know what it's like growing up on a base. And this was our first time really living on a base in Orlando. And they are they're not the world's most inspiring of places unless you're just military photographer.
Yeah, yeah, they're all very uniform and they all look the same. No matter what base you go to, they're all very just similar at the way that they've got the structures and
yeah, so you basically, you know, at that point, especially considering I can drive at this point, I just started, I'm not going to say spreading my wings, but I did start trying to like go out of my way to make photos or to capture something that was not just my usual routines or so, which was school and after school jobs and that sort of thing. So
at that point, what was it about that particular type of landscape that you found yourself drawn? Like, why were you drawn to that per se versus, you know, you could have been photographing people in the streets, you know? Like, what was it about?
Because it was Orlando and there's nobody in the streets there.
So, well, people on the beach. How about that?
And also, you're in the middle of Florida. So we're not necessarily near the beach.
Yeah.
And there was always this part of me that, like, because you take pictures or so, like, there was always this part of me where there were, you know, always the prettier girls in school would just be like, oh, take my picture. And it's just like, I don't really do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it just seemed, it wasn't that interesting to me at the time. So at the time, I think I was just trying to push towards taking interesting, I'm not going to say landscapes because I didn't even know what to call it at that time. It was just trying to create shapes and forms out of things that I would find. And that was pretty much it.
Interesting. And so moving forward just a bit. So now we're in Orlando, you're in school, you're, you know, you're doing your thing. At what point, or I guess even better, what did you decide to do after high school? What did you decide as far as like college was concerned, and what made you choose that particular major?
I had my heart set on going to Southern Illinois University because they had a good journalism program there. And I ended up more or less ended up at LSU because it was, I had an aunt and uncle that lived there. And eventually my mom, who lived in St. Louis at the time, even though my dad had custody of me, she wound up in Louisiana. And this was maybe right before high school ended. And so like pretty much my entire mom's side of the family somehow or another wound up in Louisiana, even though they had been in parts like St. Louis and in Mississippi. But Nelson, the entire other half of the family lives in Louisiana. I wound up going to LSU because I could get in state. It's not like I came from a rich family or that sort of thing. And, you know, my dad's solution was just, you know, it's like, I'll help the best I can, but he's like, you need to figure this out. And this, I literally would have been the first male on him to go to school, to go beyond high school. You know, it's like, my dad, he comes up, he goes straight to Vietnam. My grandfather, he goes straight to World War II. My great-grandfather, that wasn't even an option. So, yeah, and my mom's side of the family was pretty much the same. You know, it's like everybody went out and worked right away. So I decided to go to LSU instead. And there I decide that, like, I'm going to just do political science and history. And they do have a photo program there. Well, it's not a program. It's more like you could minor in photography, but but they also had an MFA program there. However, they were teaching people to become teachers. And I just kind of looked at how my teachers lived. And I mean, like, they're all lovely people, but I just decided this is not for me. One of them, you know, it's just like, yeah, you guys are in this small town taking, you know, it's Baton Rouge, and you guys are taking pictures of every now and then. You guys apply for a grant once every 2 years, and you get to go off someplace exotic and create a body of work, but then you come back here and teach, and you're in Baton Rouge. This is a means to an end for me. This is not, you know, and I just didn't want to teach. So I basically kind of, once again, like Orlando, I kind of, I'm not going to say I used them for their dark room, but I more or less was like, okay, well, if I can just minor here, I have dark room access. And there was a good friend of mine who finally got me out of my comfort zone, or got me out of my comfort zone of just shooting landscapes, and turned me into where basically it was just like, you know, you're really good at portraits whenever you do something. And then it turned into where it just turned into human figure. And I discovered I was really good at it. And that the other photographers who I was really admiring at the time were guys like Peter Lindbergh, or guys like Robert Mapplethorpe, or my, you know, at the time, Herb Ritz. And I started doing all of these, you know, because you're in college and you are somewhat hanging out with some of the more artistic crowd or so at the time, you realize like, oh, I'm actually surrounded by very good looking people, because you're young and everybody wants to be immortalized. You end up creating this body of work. And I want to say that there was a gallery owner who had seen a student show that I had something in. And mine, of course, was very different than everybody else's, because naked people. And but not sort of documentary sort of naked photos. It was more like in the vein of what, you know, just Herb Ritz or Bruce Weber or that sort of thing, where it's just like everyone's beautiful, everyone's pretty. There's a lot of light and shadow being interspersed, or it's like model, you know, gripping onto like some old rusted air vein or air conditioner vent or something on a
very
roof
artistic.
Someplace that we probably should not be. And that art dealer, she wound up giving me my first solo show in New Orleans. This was maybe by this time it's senior year of LSU. And I sold a few prints to, I guess, the well-to-do of New Orleans. And all of a sudden I realized that, like, oh, this could actually be a career. And so I spent, after I graduated from LSU, I spent another year in New Orleans just kind of hanging out and not really doing much of anything, because all I had to do was do a shoot every now and then. And I, because it's also New Orleans in the early 90s, you could live very cheap, especially when you're 23 years old. And I also ended up getting a couple of, I guess, hair clients or salon clients or so. And so you could bill them for a decent amount. And that was pretty much how I made ends meet, was just doing stuff like that until, I want to say, maybe Hurricane Andrew came along. And then there was just, I don't know what happened, but I just decided I needed to, quote unquote, grow up and get back on track of the political science degree that I had in my hands. And by that time, my dad was in D.C. He was stationed outside of Andrews Air Force Base. And so I was just like, Dad, I want to come there to DC, and I'm just going to study for the LSAT. So I go to DC and end up getting a volunteer job at the Smithsonian in their Office of Photographic Services.
Oh, wow.
And there was a great guy there named Dane Penland who kind of took me under his wing. Meanwhile, I'm studying for LSAT, and they ended up offering me, like, from going from volunteer to getting this entry-level job, basically scanning negatives and doing things that taking pictures of documents. No, I did not take pictures of precious art or artifacts or that sort of thing. It was mainly like boring, like World War II manifests or that sort of thing. You know, it's like, oh, we have to, before we put all this stuff in cold storage, you know, you're sitting there like basically grinding it out with a 35 millimeter on top of a copy stand. And that's pretty much your whole day. It's just, you know, sitting there replicating documents and then scanning the stuff and putting it up online. Fast forward another, say, 2 years of doing that, and they send me up to New York just to go to VizCom. Not like they wanted me to do anything. They were all going, what I like to call the adults at the Smithsonian in that department, were all going to look at new cameras and new gear and that sort of thing. And they were just like, hey, you want to come with us? And I was just like, yeah, sure. Free trip to New York. Why not? And of course, while there, I kind of parlayed what I was doing. I just, you know, walked the floor. So, and this was probably around like 96 or so. And at that time, there was a gazillion stock agencies in New York. There was Tony Stone, there was FPG. There was Getty, which would eventually rule them all. But there was also this little place called, this cheesy as the name was, the Stock Market. And they eventually got bought by Corvus Outline, which was the stock agency that Bill Gates used to own. But at the time, I met the owner's son. And sure enough, they kind of took my card and took my information. Then about like maybe 7 or 8 months later, I get a phone call from them. And they were like, would you like to come up here and talk about what it is you do at the Smithsonian? So started off the gig as a keyworder for their, at the time they were making CDs. This will show you how old it was. Like there was no on the website was just like a phone number and that sort of thing. And so then it turned into scanning their archive and showing them how they could scan the archive. And that's kind of what got me to New York. And by that time I had given up on the idea of the LSAT. And I was just like, I want to go to New York and I want to try and make a go at being a photographer. But I kind of always looked at it as like, I needed a job.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I love about what you just, about everything that you just said is, I guess to sum it all up, the importance of, you know, getting out and, you know, showing your work, first of all. And I know in that instance, you didn't necessarily have a portfolio or anything that you were showing, you know, the people who work for that, for the stock market or whatnot. But even just going back to having your work shown in New Orleans and then, you know, doing your thing. And then, you know, even though you ended up switching gears and moving up to DC, I love how it always just keeps coming back to some form of photography, like some shape or form, like you're being drawn back to it, like consistently. And then something else that I tell people all the time is, you know, sometimes the most important thing you can do is just show up and be in the room. And so for you to agree to go to VizCon and walk around and then, you know, be friendly, like that ultimately led you to New York, you know, in a roundabout way. So like, I love hearing those stories where it's like, you know, I randomly did XYZ. I met this person and then here I am,
Oh, and for your listeners, Viscom is now called Photo Plus.
Now, do they still do Photo Plus? Because
they didn't last year, but I would imagine that, you know, they're probably going to make a return, if not this year, definitely probably following year.
You know what? I think I'm thinking about their publication. Didn't they have a publication that went under or something like that? Or maybe I'm getting it confused.
You're thinking of PDN.
PD, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize that's what it was called prior to it being Photo Plus.
It used to be called Viscom, and then stand for Visual Communications. And then I think maybe around 2000 or so, they probably changed the name to Photo Plus.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, about yours. Look, my philosophy, and I'm sure this has gotten very long-winded, but my philosophy has always been that it's like, I always considered photography along the lines of like, oh, not everyone gets to play for the Yankees, but you're definitely never going to play for the Yankees if you can't even just try and walk on the team, you know, to get, at least get to the stadium. Yeah, and then like from the stadium, find a way inside. Then from inside, find a way down to the manager's office and just be like, suit me up, coach. And that's kind of how I think I approached New York, even if it was on a subconscious level. It was just like, okay, I want to do this. I think I can do this. Not really sure, but we're going to give it a shot. And if it doesn't work out, well, I've got like regular job to fall back on in the industry. And that's kind of how I operated for the better part of probably about 15 years here in New York.
Okay. You said you were a keywordist, but when did you, I guess, or even during that time, were you also engaging in personal projects? Like, how were you keeping the creative?
Yeah, I was doing a handful of things. I mean, like, I think my goal was always... like, you know, I'd look at, like, say, Richard Avedon's portfolio from, like, the 70s or so of when he went to the White House and photographed what was then, oh, let's be honest, at the time, they were probably war criminals at the time. It was, like, Donald Rumsfeld, young Dick Cheney, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, here's a guy who's pretty much known for shooting fashion and celebrities, but if you play your cards right at this game, they let you photograph people. And I'm not saying the celebrities or that sort of people. They bring joy and entertainment to millions, and they are normally the top of their craft. But you also look at it as, oh, if you play your cards right, you can actually be in the same room and photograph people who shape the way that we live. And there's something, it's not for everyone. I, you know, don't think everyone out there probably looks at it quite the same way, but I have always found that fascinating. And I knew that when I got here to New York, that they're not just going to let you start just shooting, you know, important people. I seriously doubt if even the city councilman for Clinton in Manhattan's going to sit for you. But you know what you could probably do? Take some of these black and white portraits you have and march into a modeling agency and say like, hey, can I shoot one of your girls? And that led towards a lot of comedy of errors and a lot of bad work from, like, you know, the early 2000s that no one shall ever see. Some of it's still good. Some of it's okay, but like a lot of it's just really just, I look back on it and shake my head and just go, what was I thinking? But I learned a lot about what not to do. And I also learned a lot about, like, surround yourself with people who are moving in the same direction that you want to go in visually. That is my one piece of advice for young photographers, especially if you're going to start shooting fashion or anything that involves a team, or if it's beauty or so. Ultimately, it is your decision and your creative, especially if it's on testing or it's a collaboration. but make sure that the people who you bring on board are rowing in the same direction that you want to go in to, because if everyone comes into it with their own ideas, they might be brilliant ideas, but if you're not all on the same page, the end result sometimes is, let's just put it like this. Freeform jazz is great in music. It's not necessarily a recipe for success sometimes when creating a strong vision.
Listen, I love that analogy, because that is actually the perfect way to frame it, because I too have fallen victim to, and I think that's just one of those lessons that, you know, sometimes you got to learn it the hard way. So for anybody listening, hopefully you can learn from our mistakes. But yeah, I've totally had those situations where we were all playing from a different sheet of music and it ended up being hot garbage and we wasted time and money. So yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, that's pretty much my origin story. I mean, like, I made it out of the stock world because it was just stock advertising. And
give me an example of like what kind of, like, just throw out a couple of examples of something that you might have been shooting for stock advertising.
Oh, I wasn't even shooting this stuff at the time.
Oh, you were still doing the keyboarding.
No, by that time I had graduated on to helping them scan, and we basically had an active website at that point, and more or less I was doing editing for them as well. And I want to say that by the time Corbis came along and bought that company, this is probably 2004, 2005. And at that point or so, I had had a few modest successes. You know, it was just like I'd been here for a good 6 years or so, and I had managed to get a small advertorial with El Humo Vogue, and you know, they paid for it. That was great. I'd gotten a couple of other little smaller jobs or so. And so I was just like, when Corbis bought the company, and the old boss there, a guy by the name of Richard Steedman, who's a bit of a legend in the stock world, he did something unheard of that you will probably never, ever see again. He made out rather well, him and his family, because they built this company from the ground up from the 70s or so. But he did a profit sharing with everybody as he was leaving.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was very old school. It was very much like, wow, businesses don't do this anymore, and the photo world will never see his kind again. But he basically kind of divvied it up by years of that you were there and paid everyone from down to the mailroom to everyone else. Now, true, of course, he probably knew what was coming. So a year later, you know, the layoffs start to come. But still at the time, it was just like, wow, I got this and I got a nice severance package and I'm going to see if I can freelance for a while. So I did that for a little bit of time. And then I think the next thing that came along was a celebrity agency ended up, after more or less freelancing for about a year or so, I was just like, okay, well, you've had your fun. You've gotten a couple of placements here or there, but it's still a bit of a struggle. And New York rent is not cheap. It's like, okay, so I don't want to assist for anybody. And I just never could wrap my head around that whole way of living. And so I ended up getting a job with this agency called Retina. They were a celebrity photo agency. They did a lot of red carpet coverage, but they also had a great archive of old Brit rock and roll images, and they were starting to move a bit into celebrity portraiture. Also, I thought it would be kind of nice that I could take on Contour Outline, which was at the time the number one celebrity photo resale. Not like as far as like, you know, your high-end portraiture. So like, say, if someone like Mark Seliger at the time, I believe he was probably with Corbis Outline back then, his, you know, the interior art or whatever was not used of maybe the cast of Seinfeld winds up with Corbis Outline, and then say like a small German magazine might be able to come in and license a photograph of Julia Louis-Dreyfus. More or less, I'm doing this for Ratna. I come in as a photo editor. There was, at the time, the CFO there, a woman by the name of Jessica Daly. She knew I could shoot, and so she had me start producing their pop-up studios that they did, like, out at Sundance.
Yeah.
And so I go out to Sundance, and we also did something, I think, with an MTV, like at the MTV Movie Awards or so. And the idea was just that they were trying to compete with Wire Image at the time. And it was a rather strange thing because the studios were going to some of the older photographers there. There was a woman there who had been doing it out at Sundance since the inception of Sundance. And except at the time, Wire Image came along and they had guys who were younger and hungrier. And they were doing a much better job than just, oh, let me take, you know, the celebrity and put them by the window of the Four Seasons Hotel and just do natural sunlight portraits. And it was like, yeah, that might have worked maybe, you know, 10 years ago, but it's not going to work now. Like, everything's really produced, even with these pop-up studios. Mm-hmm. And so I go out there, produce some work for them, and then I want to say that maybe about like 5 months later or so, my first big break was that one of the Bauer magazines called up. I think it was J14 at the time. They called Retina because their photographer, somehow or another, their photographer did not, I don't recall exactly what happened, but they needed a photographer fast to go down to, I want to say it was the Parker Meridian in Midtown. And they wanted to just, here, we've got like these two girls there from this thing called High School Musical. And we've got a reporter going, but we need photos. Mm. And Jessica was just like, well, let's see who we can get. So I go down the list and call. I even called someone who's been on your podcast. And of course, we had no money.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It was basically like, here's $400 and you can own it.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. And but there's going to be an embargo because, you know, J14 is going to run them for 90 days and they get to run whatever they want for free in perpetuity. But we weren't getting anyone because needed someone within 2 hours or so. Mm. And Jess just looked at me and she was just like, do you want to do it? And I was just like, yeah. And just didn't think that that was an option. And I was like, I have a camera here. Fortunately, the good thing was that old New York, especially back in the aughts or so, everything was kind of centered around Chelsea at the time. So I just literally went to PhotoCare, grabbed a pack, grabbed a flash, and took a dear friend of mine who worked there with me at the time, Alexa Flora, and we went to the Parker Meridian, and the people from J14 thought it was just going to be, they were just like, oh, just photograph these two girls, like, you know, in the lobby or like, you know, handheld.
Yeah.
And then I was just like, I did what they wanted. Then, like, we're looking at their publicist, and I was just like, you know, if we could take them over to this lobby area and sit them down, like, you know, outside of right where all these people are at, I can probably create something a lot nicer. I actually have lighting here. And they were just like, oh, we can't, you know, the hotel won't allow that. And then one of the actresses was like, well, my room's upstairs if you want to go upstairs. It's just like, and the publicist was like, I don't know about this. I was like, oh, we'll be in and out. It'll be great. Actress was Vanessa Hudgens.
Oh, wow.
A very young Vanessa Hudgens and Ashley Tisdale. So all of us went up to the hotel room and shot a quick shoot, and the photos just went everywhere.
That's what's up.
And it literally bought like the next camera and a lighting kit. And I have to honestly say that maybe it's calm because it was the time and because it was just right at the time of the explosion of High School Musical. It was literally the one of the most successful sets that I've ever done.
Wow.
And that's kind of my long-winded story of how I photographed my first celebrity.
Well, you know, what I love about all of that is how everything lined up, first of all. Everything lined up, and you were the one that was meant to do this shoot. And on top of that, you, instead of just going by what the brief was, you know, like, okay, this is what you want, some handheld stuff we can, you know, be in and out, you decided to take it a step further, and basically you did it. It reminds me of something that Chris Sorensen, another guest from the podcast, had said. He said sometimes you, during every shoot, you need to make sure to get something for yourself. And honestly, I know that you knew you had whatever the shot was that they wanted, but you saw that opportunity, and tell me if I'm wrong, but you saw that there could be a better photo that you might have wanted for yourself. You know what I'm saying? Was it for you or was it for them? Because I would have been like, it would have been for me, but you know, I could see it being...
Because I worked for the agency, I saw it as being, it's for me, but mm-hmm. it's also for myself in a way. But honestly, at the time, because it was a weird situation, because they never had anyone there who could actually shoot. They had people there who could shoot, but they went out and shot concerts, so they shot red carpets. This was, you know, something rather strange and rather weird. And the fact that, like, here's this guy who's an editor there and an assignment editor, and I just assigned myself. And it was like, no, not really. We tried calling several people. No one was there. I stepped in. And that's honestly been the story of a lot of my career after that. It was just like, do you want to do this? Okay, you don't. I will make a few other calls. And then whenever people weren't willing to do things or so, I basically kind of,
you said, were the backup plan.
I am the backup plan. And I guess that is my other piece of advice to young photographers or people who might be listening or wondering about things. It's like, you know, if you can see a way where there is a benefit for yourself, even if it's not paying you exactly what it is that you would like to ideally be paid for something, it is normally, if you can see a way to make something happen for yourself that will open up a door for you beyond that shoot, go for it. Okay. Because our industry is one of those things where there's very few of us that the red carpet is just rolled out for and doors are just automatically opened or parted for. But you have to make your own opportunities, and you have to be willing to, you know, do sort of your own sort of advocacy, because no one's going to advocate for you the way that you can advocate for yourself. A lot of my quote unquote personal work at that point just turned into, okay, who do I know that's a PR agent? Can I call said PR agent? Who do you have client-wise? Who can I shoot or work on? Basically, a lot of it, I treat it like I was testing, like it was the old days, but instead of shooting fashion, you're shooting, you know, up-and-coming actors and actresses, and you're gambling sometimes. Like, you never, I'm not shooting people who aren't on network TV or don't have, you know, a project out or a film out or so, but it's normally, sometimes it's not top of the call sheet. Sometimes it's like, you know, the fourth or fifth billed person.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, well, this gets further doors open, and it's a way of building the book. And that was kind of what I did for a very long time while working for Retina, and then Retina eventually led towards me getting a job at the New York Daily News. So I felt like that kind of came full circle. You know, I didn't go to journalism school, but I wound up at New York Daily News as Retina more or less started to, I'm not going to say necessarily, it was market factors. You know, it's like Getty was becoming stronger and stronger, and all the smaller photo agencies, you know, Getty pretty much bought up. And that was pretty much the end of an era. And I want to say that probably came to a conclusion, or it started to rapidly decline around 2010. And that's around, I think by 2011 or so, I was firmly at Daily News by that time as photo editor, taking a nighttime job with the idea that, oh, I can work during the day and I can, you know, get a client here to there during the day and try and still work my magic wherever I can. And I'll just go in and edit features and their smaller entertainment page for them at night.
When it came to, I guess, the work that you were doing as a photo editor, and just so I'm clear, because I know there's different types of photo editing, are we talking photo editor like you're editing, like you're actually editing photos, or photo editor like you're the photo editor responsible for, you know, like coordinating shoots and picking images that are going to be used for both? Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. So what I love talking to the, you know, to photo editors, because it's interesting to hear their perspective on, you know, what they need from a shoot. Because I know, you know, going into editorial shoots, and there's like some magazines that I work for, you know, here in Baltimore and in the DC area, the editor will be like, okay, we need XYZ. And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get XYZ, just like you said in your, with your situation with the High School Musical actresses. You had the brief and you did what you were supposed to do. But in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get what you need, but I'm going to do the shots that I want. And then I'll do those shots. And then sometimes the editor will just go with the ones that they originally wanted. And I'll be like, well, damn, like these other ones that I shot are like way better. But I also, you know, have to remember that from the photo editor standpoint, they have, you know, they have a story and context that they need to keep everything within. And sometimes it doesn't always, sometimes they don't need all that extra. Sometimes they just need somebody on Seamless. You know what I'm saying? So I'd love to hear more about your perspective as a photo editor in that regards, and some things that you could possibly, you know, share with our listeners to kind of help guide them in that process of working with a photo editor.
I kind of always looked at it as, a lot of times, especially when I was at Retina or so, and especially if you're assigning something, or if we did take on production for a client or for even another magazine, they normally have a brief or they have a deck that they want. And you basically go in and just tell the photographer. And fortunately, you know, being a photographer, I just always looked at it, it's like, look, I get it, I understand, but this is what the client wants. And they are paying for all of us to be here. So let's give them what they want. And if time permits afterwards, yeah, you do whatever you want to do, you know, within reason or that sort of thing. And I guess because I've always had that sort of business savvy, or I've always seen, like, you know, the numbers side of things, I understand more, like, when I am on, like, a bigger job, like, say, for one of my advertising jobs or so with a celebrity. And, yeah, good example would be something that I just did recently, and billboards in New York, billboards in LA, beautiful work. Okay. But the nicer stuff didn't necessarily get approved. The stuff that I am absolutely in love with, it's not necessarily fitting for the client. and you have to also the celebrity at the time. I'm not sure if he killed it or if his team killed it, but I also respect that and I understand that because they paid advertising rates. And ultimately, what's the best way to put this? Yes, I created something that I feel is gorgeous. And I also know that if I showed it to other people in the photo community, they will also think it's gorgeous. However, it is of a subject. And it is not like someone who I photographed on the street. It is someone who basically walked into the studio. And so you do have a little element of trust there that I feel that you have to respect your subject's wishes. And I know that there's a lot of photographers out there sometimes, especially in fashion, where they don't necessarily respect that. But the moment you start photographing people with not just bookers, but with agents, talent agents and management teams, and the moment you start photographing people like under a corporate banner or so that is advertising, then that's when you just basically, as I like to put it, they're hiring you for your talent and they're hiring you for your artistic vision, but they'd like for your artistic vision to fit within their vision. And you have to be willing to do that. And you have to be willing to sometimes, if it's a great idea, if it's a really wonderful idea, go play that idea out with another subject or so. It's still going to be there. It's still going to be a great idea. And if it's a strong image, it will still be a strong image, even if it's not necessarily a face that someone might recognize right away. And you guys can go to my website and you can, or go to my Instagram page and try and figure out which shoot it is that I'm talking about. But I am not going to be spilling the tea here, so to speak.
Yeah. And we will definitely have a link up to all of your social media handles and websites. So yeah, we'll let them play that game for themselves. Oh man. Okay. Last question, because I know we're just about out of time. We've covered quite a bit, and I feel like even the way that you're framing your career and the way that you go about doing things, what I love about it, and I think the lesson that it teaches, is that there's more than one way to skin a cat. And like you said, the overarching theme of your whole career is like, I'm going to find the back door in and I'm going to, you know, make some stuff happen, which is ultimately what you've done. You found your work in major publications with major corporations and companies. And like you have made a name for yourself, and your work like truly speaks for itself. So it's like that mindset, I think, is definitely something that people should consider if they, you know, if they want to get started in with a career in photography. And like you said, you know, some, you might not play for the Yankees, but you know, if you don't even try to go to the field, if you don't try to show up in the room, if you don't try to slide in somebody's DM to see if there's an opportunity to make your opportunities, like none of that's going to happen. And I feel like you're a living example of that. So that's why I don't feel like, especially for time's sake, there's not a whole lot of time to really dig as deep as I would like to. But me and you're going to have another conversation over drinks when I can finally make it up to New York again and it's safe to do so. But I feel like we've got a lot more to talk about offline. But yeah, last question. And it's more of a, I want you to kind of give an account, because you had made a mention of this in a post long ago, and it was a story about one of your, and I don't know at what point in your career you photographed him, but what was his name? Alan Rickman? Yeah. Like you'd had a little story that you had posted. And I think it was around the time that he had passed, which is why you posted, and you kind of told the story of how you met him and how, you know, how that shoot came about. But can you retell that story here?
Yeah, that was a great shoot. It was, yeah, actually, what's so funny is now that I think about it, there's three people that are no longer with us that I have photographed throughout my career. And they've been kind of icons. Yeah. And at the time, and honestly, it's not even my best work, but, you know, I photographed Kobe. Mm-hmm. A year before he died, I photographed DMX. Yeah, thank you for reminding me. I forgot about, yeah, I photographed DMX also. And I got to photograph Alan Rickman. And it was so funny. He was in this little small movie with Eliza Dushku. And I was all about, like, I was just like, it's just Hans Gruber. I was like, I really want to photograph Faith the Vampire Slayer. And, but the great thing was that Rickman was so just gracious and just lovely. And he was also a little shocked that I did not necessarily, everybody, I guess, asked him about Hans Gruber. Here's the one thing I can tell, offer advice for if you are photographing celebrities. Talk about something obscure with them that they are really passionate about, or talk about a movie that they're not exactly expecting you to love. And I went in and talked about Love Actually, which is no pun intended, one of my favorite Christmas movies. And I just absolutely loved his character and his portrayal of this man who, middle age, who's, you know, has this flirtatious thing going on with a secretary. And I think he was a little taken. He was just a little shocked that, you know, here's this black guy who didn't want to talk about an action film or didn't want to talk about one of his villainous roles, but instead wanted to talk about like one of his turns as a comedic actor. And that kind of broke the ice with him. So that's normally my suggestion to anyone who's out there photographing famous people. A lot of times you get 5 minutes. Okay. You spend more time setting up two or three different looks that you go through with your assistants, and you basically get there 2 to 3 hours in advance to pre-light. Celeb comes in. You are lucky if, you know, 5 minutes, if you can charm them. You can sometimes keep them there for another 10 or 15, but don't always count on that. And that was my story about Mr. Rickman. He ended up staying around, gave us an extra 20 minutes and he was just really just great. And so right around the time he passed, I think I did, I did make that post. And it was just one of those things where I was just like, he was such a lovely gentleman.
That's what's up. That's what's up. Now, because you mentioned the other people, I got to ask, what was DMX? What was that experience like? And you photographed him for BET, right?
Yeah, I photographed him for BET. He was late, as you would, as one would expect. And it all of a sudden clicked as to why Hollywood, because you listen to his music and he's really rough. Okay, it's just like the whole persona, you know, riding four-wheelers up and down like city streets and stuff. And however, you meet him in real life and he is just lovely. You can also see where having a couple of family members who have mental issues, you could see where the cracks were. And what was, DMX was charming, he was funny, he was insightful, but I also felt very sad because you could see where the talent was, except he was so much larger than the people surrounding him that unfortunately there was nobody there to just rein back some of, you know, the darkness that was there, or some of the issues that were there and some of the self-medication that was going on.
Yeah.
So, but he was really, really funny and very insightful. Okay. We just started talking about politics, and he was just extremely well-versed and well-knowledged.
Wow. I think this, like you said earlier, like this job affords us the opportunity to be in the room with some pretty amazing, some pretty interesting, some, you know, all the other adjectives that you can think of. And some of them aren't always the best, but it allows us the opportunity to be in the room with some pretty amazing people and have these type of stories and experiences. And it just, you know, it's one more reason why I love what it is that we do. And I can tell that you definitely love what it is that you do and all of the many forms that you operate within this industry.
Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
The job is a lot of fun. It's very rewarding. It's not necessarily glamorous. You are hired to photograph glamorous people. And I think that where some photographers sometimes run into a bit of trouble is that they kind of forget that they're not the glamorous one. The subject is. And whether that be the city councilman, whether that be the author, whether that be the young up-and-coming actor or the sports star. But I do feel that, like, you know, you can make your way in this field. You just have to be willing to work hard, treat everybody with respect that you encounter. Basically, when you're on one of these big sets, be nice to everyone. Because the reality is that, yeah, that person there who's an intern right now for the photo team, you don't know where they are going to wind up at 4 or 5 years from now. And you don't want to be the person that, oh yeah, I'm not hiring that person. They were rude to me. It's like, no, you're in this rarefied position, this rarefied air where you're on a client job. And there's a lot of your fellow photographers that don't get that opportunity. And to be honest with you, there's a lot of people of color who don't necessarily get that opportunity. Things are changing, but took a man in, you know, Minnesota being killed by a guy who's supposed to be there protecting us and to get killed on national TV. And then we had to threaten to burn this whole place down to a cinder to get some sort of parity in our system. And we're not even close to being at that point. Okay. But as I like to put it, you know, things are better for me now than they were, say, even when I first started out. Doors have opened that, honestly, talent has a lot to do with it. But I look back upon where we're almost at May 20. What day are we now? We're like May 18th?
19th.
May 19th. Okay, May 25th. That's when things changed. I would trade in any of the success for the past year or so to have Mr. Floyd back with us. Take this to photographers of color. I say, take this opportunity that the landscape is shifting and put your best foot forward and just keep on creating.
I just want to thank you again, Derek, for taking the time to chat with me and impart these pearls of wisdom that you have shared with us all. And, you know, much more success to you. And like I said, man, next time I'm up in New York and it's safe to do so, which I feel like is coming pretty soon, even though I feel like we're kind of jumping the gun a little bit, I'm going to hit you up. I'm going to hit you up, man, because I'm fully vaxxed and I'm ready to party, baby.
Fully vaxxed. My partying days might be a little over at this point, but no, definitely hit me up. And look, thank you for having me on. Okay. I feel like I'm just in really good company because I've seen the people you've been talking to and their work is just incredible and amazing. And I'm just kind of like, why am I here again? But no, thank you.
No, you know why you're here. You deserve to be on the walls with the rest of these guys. And, you know, I'm just glad that I could take the time to have this conversation with you now. So thanks again, Derek.
All right. Take care, man.
All right, that is the show. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Derek. I definitely found it to be very informative, and I learned a few things about him that I didn't know previously. So it's always the power of having good conversation. And if you enjoyed this conversation, please don't hesitate to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast. You can go to our website, whatmakesyouclick.com, to check out the show notes and see any of the resources that were mentioned in this episode. I can't recommend doing that enough. I mean, I always am blown away by the level of information and resources that my guests share. So check out those show notes. You can also engage with us on Instagram at What Makes You Click. And lastly, if you found benefit in this show or any of the other episodes, please feel free to share it with anybody else that you think might find value in it. All right, guys, until next time.